Hi everyone. Thanks for joining us for this series of iDug podcasts where we speak to some great people in the DB2 community. I'm Marcus Davidge.
And I'm Julia Carter, and we represent the iDug Content Committee. We hope you enjoy today's edition.
So it's a great delight for me to introduce Joe Geller to today's podcast. Joe has been a member of the iDug Content Committee for a while. He's an IBM champion, presented at conferences, been voted best user speaker twice. And he's also on the board of directors for the Tridex DB2 user group in New York. And he's written articles for the iDug. He's written two books, one on IMS and one on DB2. And it's a pleasure to welcome you, Joe. Thanks for attending.
Thanks, Marcus. Hi, Julia. Thank you.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for being here.
So it's not at all nepotistic that we actually invited somebody from the content committee to speak on our podcast, because Joe has got a wealth of experience and he's a really interesting guy. So, Joe, over to you. How did you begin your career?
Okay, well, actually, I was pretty lucky with my first job. It was a very small shop, and it's the best way to learn because everything is interconnected. You work in a large shop, even one that believes in moving you around and so on, and chance to get different experiences. At any one time, you're working on doing one thing. You may be a DBA, you may be a programmer, you may be production support, but that's what you're doing. And you know, to do one thing, to do it well, you need to know all the related things. If you're a programmer accessing databases, you can do a much better job if you understand database design and relationships between tables, as well as the physical design, what indexes exist, and so on. And, and of course, you know, the specific database for your application, but just understanding how that all works and fits together, you can write better code and it'll perform better. If you're training to be a DBA, you may be involved in database design, or you may not. You may just be doing, you know, creating tables and support. But even if you're doing the database design and modeling, if you don't understand SQL coding, how the data is accessed, you can't do it as effectively as you could. Mm-hmm. And so the best way is to be knowledgeable in all those things. And it's even better if you can work on both of those things at the same time. You know, because you know what you're doing, how it fits together, and so on. And all the other related technology also helps. You know, CICS, you know, what does it mean to do online programs versus batch programs? What are your options in CICS or Java in a web-based application? Knowing about networking and so on. So, as I said, it was a very small shop. Located at Research Institute for Mental Hygiene. We built information systems, you know, for facilities under IMS in those days. And there were a handful of programmers, you know, 3 to 6 programmers, you know, at different times. No DBA department. So, of course, one of the first things I did was volunteer to do the database design for the things we're building. And that, of course, you know, always volunteer to do something new, you know, that needs doing. You know, and get to learn it and so on. But also I got familiar with, you know, the characteristics of disk drives and tapes, you know, the performance characteristics, capacity, fitting things in. And of course, that's later on with DB2, that's related to space allocation, you know, and tracks and cylinders and, you know, primary quantity and secondary quantity in DB2, you know, before the automatic, you know, allocations that you can do today. And all of that stuff. So it was terrific. It was a great learning experience. Learning different things. I mean, it also comes in handy. You know, I'm going to jump around in time. You know, we had a performance problem not long ago, a batch job that used to run 20 minutes, but, you know, now that getting told by the development team, it's been running for 10 hours and it doesn't look like it's anywhere near finished. Mm. And they're seeing from their application metrics that they collected that it was running at the rate of about, well, from how slowly it was running, they could see it wasn't going to finish. Right. But each individual query, well, basically it was a batch job. They designed it where it would call a stored procedure one per record from the front end, process that record, go back, and next one, which of course is not the best design for batch in the first place.
Yeah.
But they were finding that each call, it was taking about 50 milliseconds apiece. So they want to know what's wrong in the database and so on, of course, and you blame the database.
It's always the database.
So I start by looking at the performance metrics to see, is it I.O., physical I.O., is it CPU, what is it? And DB2 tells me this thing's taking 2 milliseconds.
Oh.
So it's clearly not the database.
Right.
Okay, so, I tell them, it's either got to be your front-end code, something in your Java layer, or it could be the network.
Yeah.
And I asked them the question, is your application server in the same data center as the database server? Well, it used to be, but now we're on a new application server in a new data center.
Oh.
And it's not located anywhere geographically near the database.
Oh.
Well, knowing something about networks, it was a logical thing to ask. The development team, they didn't even want to believe me that it was just the network delay and it was because they're in the wrong data center. What can we do about it? Well, put it in a data center where it used to be.
Yeah.
Oh, well, no, management, they wanted us in the new data center.
Right. So nobody
on their team understood about networks. Whoever it was who told them to be in the new data center obviously didn't know anything about network delay, even though it was probably somebody higher up. So, the more you know about everything, the better.
Definitely. And you started with DB2 right from the beginning of DB2, didn't you?
Pretty much. I started with DB2 actually on version 1.2. And like a month later, 1.3 came out and we were on that. So it was near the beginning. It was a brand new project, but relatively small number of people. So there's no DBA department, and actually nobody there had experience in DB2 yet, because it just came out, 1.2, including me, but that's okay. But again, I volunteered to do the DBA work and to do the design and create the tables and so on. So again, I got to do both, the design of the tables, as well as the, coding for the application.
Mm-hmm.
So again, great way to, quickly build up, DB2 skills.
Yep, certainly is.
I can't really imagine trying to learn something that doesn't have a history. So what was it like to pick up this new database and have to learn all of the different elements of it and not have anyone else that you can learn from or copy from?
Well, having experience with IMS, I understood database processing in general. Although it's very, very different, between IMS and DB2. Well, the first thing is actually DB2 in those days was a lot simpler than it is now. I mean, not only was there no data sharing, there were no stored procedures, there were no online reorgs, or backups, so everything was offline. Mm. So, a lot fewer parts to have to learn.
Yeah.
The language itself was a lot simpler. No referential integrity, a lot fewer built-in functions and other things. Tuning options, nowadays DB2 does a lot of things for you with query rewrite, joins to subqueries and vice versa. Didn't have any of that. So if a join would be better than a subquery, you had to rewrite it manually. There was no transitive closure. So if you have column A equals 2 and column A equals column B, DB2 did not know that column B equals 2. So if that was going to make a difference performance-wise, you had to put that in yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, there was a lot less to learn, but...
You had to do everything yourself.
Pretty much. I mean, within a few years, the first few DB2 books had come out, so there were some, things to learn from. But there's the manuals. I mean, you read the manuals and you try things out. So, I mean, same way you do things now, you don't know everything in DB2 today.
No.
So you try it out. You think, okay, you look up in the manual to see if there, or the info center, is there something that will do this? And then you try it out and test it and see the results.
Yeah.
And see if it works the way you think and play with it. So you just did all that.
So the book that you wrote about DB2, when was that? And what was it about?
Well, the primary thing was about was DB2. well, it's called the DB2 Performance and Development Guide.
Ah, okay.
So yeah. It was about database design and database coding and performance and how to design good databases, how to design indexes, how to write efficient code, and so on. And that came out, it covered up through version 2.3.
Ah, okay.
So it was a long time ago.
Is it still available, though? Can I look for it on Amazon?
You can find used copies on Amazon pretty cheaply.
Really? Oh,
and they're worth every penny. I think you can get it for a couple of dollars. Everything in it is accurate,
yeah,
but it's out of date by quite a bit now. So, but
excellent.
Yes, feel free to buy
one. I can have a look, yeah.
But, you know, one of the questions you guys ask other people on the podcast, and I've heard elsewhere, is, you know, what do I think is the best new feature added that was not there in the very beginning?
Yeah.
And everybody has good answers. You know, somebody once said referential integrity. I think Dan on his podcast talked about the introduction of SQL stored procedures, which is absolutely great feature. But I have one that I think beats all of those. And I have a second. In second place, I have one that Julian mentioned on his podcast, which is DB2 packages. Mm-hmm. I mean, he alluded to that because before that, all the programs that could be invoked in that execution had to be all bound together into the plan. And anytime you changed one small thing in one program, the whole thing got rebound.
Mm-hmm.
Not only could that take quite a lot of time to complete the bind, you know, if you have 100 modules, you know, involved, but also you could get a new access path in any one of them, even if you've made no changes to all the other code. So packages came out in 2.3, and now you just bind the one program with two programs that you've changed, and that's it.
Yeah.
So that's done more for the development process and deployment process than anything else.
Yeah, it's hugely benefited availability, performance, and modularity of code. It's 2.3 was my first DB2. So my first job was to upgrade DB2 2.2 to 2.3. And obviously, I just wanted to packagize everything. And we had this IBM product, Electronic Data Interchange, EDI, I think it was called. It was done on panels. And the whole thing was just all bound in one plan. And so I thought, I'll experiment with this. And I turned the whole thing into packages.
Yeah.
And it was fun to play around with. And it just made the whole thing a lot more available whenever there was a PDF or a change that had to be made to it.
Right. Yeah.
So I packagized that before IBM themselves did.
so that was
that was number two.
That's number two. Number one is the date and time data type, which was introduced in 1.3.
What was it before?
Before it was the same as every other DBMS, including IMS. And if you're creating flat files and you have dates, everybody did it differently. Some people stored it as character strings. Some people stored it as numeric character, like COBOL PIC9, where it's treated as a number by COBOL, but it's still one byte per digit. But in those days, space was really at a premium, disk space. You know, disk drives, you know, might be a few megabytes, you know, 30 megabytes. A 100 megabyte disk drive was big. This is on mainframe. Not when DB2 came out, but before that, you know, so people coded dates in packed decimal, you know, half a byte per digit, and also in binary. You could pack each, you know, the year, month, day into binary, you know, one byte each, so it would only take 3 bytes for a full date. But of course, everybody did it differently. Some did year, month, day, some did month, day, year. Some had centuries, some did not. In fact, in the early days of data processing, very few people had the century as part of the date.
Yeah, hence the Y2K.
Of course, it gets more and more of a problem as time went on.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody did it differently. So data interchange, and even within the same shop, you know, different applications storing data dates differently, you know, it was a lot of programming effort also. So the date and time data type standardized it. It's all stored internally in DB2. The same way, even though DB2 will accept different input formats, it'll store it internally the same way. date arithmetic you can do with the date data types. You know, add 3 days to this date, you know, to get the new due date, for example. Date comparisons, you can extract the year or the month in parts. I mean, there's so much things that are so easy to do with date and time data type. Yeah. And before that, you didn't have that. I mean, I think that is the biggest improvement ever.
Definitely a good one. And I'd always just assumed that we'd had that since the beginning of EB2. But, well, what an education.
I did not know that we didn't have date time data types right at the beginning.
Maybe it's something people have blanked out.
Yeah, because it's just so ubiquitous now, isn't it?
Right, right. And of course, other DBMSs do handle them differently. So you still have conversion migration problems if you're dealing with more than just DB2.
Yeah, but I definitely was not expecting you to say that, Joe.
No, me neither.
Well, that's because you're too young.
Oh, thanks.
I worked on a product once that stored its date and time in integer. So when you were doing date and time arithmetic, like add 3 days, it was really complicated. I ended up writing, when they came out, I think it was version 5 or 6, when SQL functions came out, user-defined functions. I remember writing a function which just converted from the integer into character and then into a date and time format, just so that we could be able to do proper date time arithmetic without having to do ridiculous maths. But yeah, that's a really good feature.
In fact, I did write, you know, you can write a date and time user exit in DB2 to accept different input formats or output formats than the standard DB2 ones. And in particular, you know, the standard ones, they all have this entry as part of it. They all have a separator for the most part. But if you're still, you know, back again, you know, in the late 80s, you're still dealing with systems and files being passed that were year, month, day, you know, 6-string, no separator, no thing. So wrote a date and time exit that would accept that as an input and convert it into a DB2 acceptable input format.
So you've been working with DB2 since 1.2. So that's DB2 on Z, on Z. Have you dabbled with UDB at all, or LUW?
Yeah, I first used it in the mid-90s, doing some DBA work and a little bit of coding, not extensively. The last 12 years, I've been working mostly with LUW, and in fact, almost exclusively doing performance tuning, which is great, which is my favorite thing to do. Because, you know, query performance tuning, database tuning is a lot like detective work. Mm. You examine the evidence, you know, the performance metrics, the explain, you search for clues, you put it together, you come up with an hypothesis, you try to prove it out, and then you come up with a solution and so forth. So, I mean, to me, that's the most fun thing to do.
I like the way you've described it as well, like being a detective, because that's so true. It's how you feel when you're going through it.
Hey, right. Julia, I feel a TV show coming on. Anyway, sorry.
Did you ever have a manager who thought that anybody could do performance tuning? You know, just train everybody else to do it and, you know, it doesn't require special skills. I had one who asked me to create a checklist of things to look for, to do in order to tune the queries.
And you
need knowledge, you need experience, and you need insight, you know, and there are a lot of people who, with the experience and knowledge, you know, have the insight and can do it well, but, you know, the average person, you know, maybe not so well. And just like detective work, if anybody could do it, there'd be no need for Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, very true. It isn't just a case of following a checklist, because there are so many it depends and what ifs along the way that, yeah, you really need the experience and the knowledge. And not just follow a checklist and have a look at things in an abstract way.
But in between, I actually got into LUW extensively in the early 2000s. And this is actually my most favorite project that I've ever worked on. It was a joint project between IBM and a customer, which was a startup that was a subsidiary of a large insurance company in Chicago. And the idea, and this is in the early heydays of dot-coms and stuff and building web-based applications. So this was supposed to be a marketplace for insurance, where a user, end user like me, like you, who wants insurance of some kind, whether it's small business insurance, which is what we started the project with, or life insurance, health insurance, and so on, could go online and fill out one application that would get submitted automatically to multiple insurance carriers.
Okay.
And then the customer would say, which ones does he want it submitted to? And the system, what its purpose was to collect all the customer data and evaluate to see whether or not they would be eligible for that insurance policy that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And only the ones, if they were eligible, then it would submit the application to the insurance carriers.
Okay.
And, you know, for final processing and so on. It was heavily rules driven. I mean, the insurance industry is heavily rules driven to start with. And the intention of management was to use a commercial rules engine. Each type of insurance obviously has different rules.
Yeah.
Health insurance has different data it needs than a small business insurance. Each carrier has their own rules. The state or province you're located in has rules. And for small business insurance, even the type of business would have variability. If the business is a restaurant, then there would typically be rules like you must be within 100 feet of a fire hydrant. You know, we started gathering, you know, the rules from this one carrier for the small business insurance and looking at this rules engine, and we could see there's no way it could handle this. And to, you know, really tell what we did, there were three of us, the data architect from this other company, an IBM solution architect with strong knowledge in the insurance industry, and myself, and we built a data model to represent the rules. And the rules, in effect, were of three types: evaluation rules, display rules to control based on what was input so far. So there will also be process flow rules to control what's the next screen to bring up. And that would have a list of display rules, you know, which fields to put up, and everything was all conditional. So we built this data model, created in DB2, LUW, and started inputting all the rules that were gathered, you know, by the analysts. And I mean, we can see there's no way that this engine could handle that. But now that we had this all codified, I said, you know, we could write this ourselves. We could write a rules engine driven by the database rule, the rules stored in the database in our data model.
Right.
And management gave me permission to do a prototype. So I did a prototype, took about 3 weeks, and it worked beautifully.
Nice.
It was handling a subset of the thing. And so they gave the go ahead, let's build the thing. The reason why I like this project is because I got to do everything. I was involved in the data model, in the database design. I created the tables and stuff. And I designed and wrote the programs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a rules engine and a dynamic web page builder that would build the forms, you know, using JSPs and, you know, written in Java, fire the rules, control what would come up, build the pages, and so on. So I had my hands on everything. So we built the whole system, and the first complete version, it took about 3 months, you know, worked beautifully. They're continuing to gather, you know, the rules, you know, to build it out and so on. So the rules were, you know, simple things like expressions, you know, if this field is greater than that, then they're not eligible. This field is between here and there, and that field is equal to this, then set a value in another field, another data item, or add this display rule, you know, for the next screen to come up to collect some additional data, or to conditionally fire another rule based on what was evaluated in the first rule.
Mm-hmm. And all this is written in Java.
Well, no. It sounds like this expression evaluator is a lot of work. There's an awful, you have to write an interpreter, a parser, an interpreter, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I did it the easy way. I let DB2 do the work for me. DB2 has an expression evaluator. What I did was I took the expression from the rule, built a string using dynamic SQL, and issued a select of this expression from sys-IBM, that's sys-dummy1.
Okay.
And I could get back either a yes-no answer, or I could get back a value to put into a field specified in the rule.
So the rules were SQL-based?
The rules were expressions in general, along with what data fields are to be used, you know, where they're coming from, what the result should be, whether it's to set a value in another field or to fire another rule, you know, to be done iteratively. You know, if this data is equal to that, then fire this rule, and so on. So yes, we made the expression anything that DB2 could handle as an expression. So nice. Now, without any coding at all, we're just, you know, building up the string and calling DB2. I did not have to interpret anything, parse it, pass it on to DB2, and let DB2, so it could handle any expression that DB2 could handle, we could handle, including built-in functions, arithmetic, date and time arithmetic, anything.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Clever.
With minimal effort.
Yeah.
But then I added a generic method rule where it could call any Java method of any kind. If you're writing Java code, you can call a specific thing. So just like in DB2, you can call a stored procedure. In DB2, if you're using dynamic SQL, you could actually, since you're building up the SQL statement, you could call different stored procedures with different parameters on different executions because you're building it dynamically. Java has the same feature. It has introspection and methods. You can, by looking up a class name and method name within it, it'll give you the list of input parameters, output parameters, a result set, and then you can call it essentially dynamically. And all that can be done in Java. Okay. So we created a new rule type called a method rule, in which we would specify the class and method name, and the data list what the input and output parameters were. Invoke that method. Now, that method's just an external method in Java. It can do absolutely anything. Any kind of Java processing, it could read and write to a database.
Mm-hmm.
It could do anything. All you have to do is, you know, define the rule and put it into the rules database.
Right.
So how long were you working on? Sorry, Marcus, after you.
No, go on, Julia.
I was going to say, how long were you working on this for?
Well, the first iteration, you know, the complete thing with the basic, with the rules as I described before, it took about 3 months.
Pretty quick though, really, the whole thing.
Yeah, well, as I said, I didn't have to do all the other programs that were not directly involved in the rules engine. So, you know, I gave technical guidance to the team of developers who were doing those things. But otherwise, yeah, it wasn't that long for the basic thing. But then we had other enhancements had to make also. So the next enhancement I did was to support Oracle, this potential customer, which was also easy. I said we built up the string for the expression, but I now wrapped it inside a call, a method. In the method, it would check which DBMS are we on, and if it's Oracle, it would modify the DB2 string for the things that are different. So if it needed SysUMMI1, it would change that to the Oracle pseudo table dual. Dates and times are handled differently by Oracle, so dates and times would have to be reformatted and so on. And I didn't have to support all the Oracle DB2 differences, only the ones that I actually had in my code, which is a small number of them.
Yeah.
So that was easy.
Yeah. Just very cool that you're such a central part of such a big and impressive solution.
What I liked about this, well, first, I got to do everything from beginning to end, which I like. But the second thing is I learned an awful lot of stuff doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
especially Java related. You know, I'd never done introspection before and method calling and a lot of the other things. So I learned a lot and it worked great. So it feels great. You know, I mean, it's very satisfying.
Yeah, I love that story. It's the kind of thing that I enjoy doing is solving problems and coming up with ideas that are generic and that can be ported one way or another. There's three rules engines that I've been involved with, and each one is different from another. But I kind of like finish settled with you now on the same, we're on the same page that if DB2 can do it itself, just let it.
Right. Right. And one last thing is today, you know, machine learning is the hot technology and would fit very well with insurance and eligibility type of things.
Have you had a chance to experiment with any of those yet?
No, I haven't yet. Love to, but I haven't yet.
Yeah, they're quite exciting. But yeah, I've also not had the opportunity yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, it would fit in because we can call any Java method.
Yeah.
So that's my long story of the day.
That's a long story.
Yeah, it's really interesting and, such a very proud achievement, I'm sure.
We are recording this podcast on Zoom, so we can all see each other, the three of us. And something our podcast listeners won't notice is that Joe's backdrop is behind him is a photograph of a comet, probably taken from someone's backyard.
My front yard.
Your front yard. Okay, so...
Comet Comet Hale-Bopp in the 1990s.
Okay. 97.
Right.
Yeah. Are you a bit of an astronomer then?
Yes, I am. That is one of my hobbies, along with I play bass guitar,
right.
But not currently active like Dan is in his gigs, but had bands years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Had a folk band with my brother and his wife, and we recorded a couple of albums that we Ooh. On vinyl that we sold at at gigs, if people wow. wanted to buy. Didn't sell a lot, but it was fun. But the funny thing is, it turned out, and we found out about 10 years ago, there are people who like looking for obscure old music. And there was a guy in England who had found our album somewhere and had a scratchy version of it and stuff, and wrote, emailed, got hold of one of us, and asked, do we have any that we could send him. He and his friends are really into it. They think it's great and stuff. And then I found that somebody else took the album and put it up on YouTube, the entire album.
Oh.
So you could find it on YouTube and give it a listen if you want it.
What are we looking for?
Exactly. What are we looking for?
The band was called Quoth the Raven, like from Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe, yeah.
Right, Quoth the Raven was the band, and the album itself was called Nevermore. So of course, if you Google that, you're going to get all kinds of things that are related to Edgar Allan Poe and stuff. But if you looked for it in YouTube, I could send you the link, actually, for it.
That would be cool.
I think it would just be fun just looking for that on YouTube without the link to see what else comes up.
Other hobbies, I play tennis and softball. And the favorite thing I did in the past was I was my son's Little League manager, for Little League baseball for a lot of years. And we won two championships in 6 years.
Wow.
So very good. Excellent.
Talking about things that you've won, Joe, I dug Best Speaker twice. I imagine that it's not only a thing of pride, but you also get opportunities when you win Best Speaker, don't you?
Yeah. Well, the first time I won it, the prize was you get to present again and travel to the next conference.
Right.
Except that I won it in Lisbon in 2017 at EMEA, and the next one was Philadelphia, which is a drive for me instead of a plane flight. So I didn't need to have my plane flight paid for. So I asked them if they would pay for my next trip to EMEA, in which they said okay, instead.
Oh,
so that worked out well. And then I won the next year in Malta. And this time they said, no prize for you. We don't give it out twice.
the free,
which is okay. I'm okay with that. And then the next year I had the presentation that I really liked, and I was hoping for a three-peat, but I did. It was a top five, but it didn't win.
Yeah.
Oh,
so I was disappointed with that one.
I'm sure that every IDUG that I've been to, which is the European ones, I'm sure that you've been voted in the top 10 speakers every time. So it's pretty impressive. And there's also the North American ones that you participate in. So that's some achievement really, isn't it?
It is. It feels really good.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of great presentations at the conferences. And I understand that actually the voting, when people vote on and do the evaluation form, it comes out really close between a lot of parts. So, I've been fortunate to win it, but, because there are other great ones too.
I was going to say, we've got IDUG EMEA coming up in Prague later on this year. So let this be a lesson for all of the attendees or anybody who wants to come to IDUG EMEA. Don't forget to fill in your evaluation forms, because people like Joe need your support to get the hat trick of three in a row Best Speaker Awards.
Well, it's no longer three in a row.
Yeah.
But you guys speak also, so you need the support too. But the conferences are great. You not only get sessions, but the chance to speak one-on-one with the IBM developers and the other experts.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get that elsewhere. I've had performance problems at work. We submitted PMRs waiting for answers, and then a conference came up shortly thereafter, and I went to the optimizer people and told them my problem. This was LUW, so it was John Hornibrook. He had answers for both of my problems. The set of people who go to the conference, and what a great bunch of people to spend a week with.
We have a lovely community of people.
We do. I mean smart, interesting people, terrific. It's just such a worthwhile
it's invaluable.
Use of your time, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you there.
Yeah. And so the one last thing in terms of what I've been doing lately, So as I said, I've been concentrating on performance the last 10 years and two-thirds of it at JP Morgan Chase. But as of August 4th, just 2 weeks ago from when we're recording this, I am now retired.
Congratulations.
Yay.
Thank you.
But what are we going to do without you?
Well, now I'm still on the content committee and still involved in Tridex. And the content committee actually takes up a lot of time because, you know, reviewing articles and reading articles and stuff and curating. Yeah, so
absolutely. Do you have plans for life beyond DBT?
Yeah, just basically all the things I don't have time for and still don't have time for. You know, reading. Yeah. All kinds of things. I like astronomy. I like all kinds of science, all kinds of computer stuff. Keep up with DB2, movies, music. There's just too much. Too much to do, even, you know, full time.
Yeah, exactly. All the stuff you don't have time for.
Right.
Well, it's been an absolute delight to catch up with you, Joe. Thank you very much for agreeing to be our guest here on iDug DB2 Table Talk. We will speak to you soon on the content committee. But I'd just like to thank you for all of the wisdom that you've imparted to us today and for the involvement in iDug over the last, well, many years. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you both. Great speaking with you.
Visit iDug.org for the latest DB2 community news, information about events, and all of our technical content. Tune in again soon for the next podcast at idog.org/podcast.